Hiya, Tim here, and before the podcast, I have a quick note. Due to rights reasons, the songs have been shortened for this podcast. Every song is taken from Inspiral Carpet's Life. All tracks are written by Inspiral Carpet's. It was released on 23rd of April 1990 on Mute Records. Enjoy.
Where real music matters.
Absolute Radio.
Tim's Listening Party.
Hiya, it's Tim's Listening Party on Absolute Radio. I'm Tim Burgess, and welcome to another episode of my show in which I sit down with a band, going through a classic album and hearing the stories behind it. Catch up with recent listening parties with the likes of Cast, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, Royal Blood and Nile Rodgers. To catch up on any of these episodes, just search for Tim's Listening Party wherever you get your podcasts or on the Rayo app. Remember, it's not a listening party if you don't get involved on social media, so message me throughout the show using the hashtag Tim's Listening Party, and check out @Tim_Burgess and @Absolute Radio for more listening party content. This episode, I'm joined by Graham Lambert and Clint Boone from Inspiral Carpet to talk about their debut album, Life, on its 35th anniversary. Life hit the number 2 spot on the UK album charts in 1990, and Inspiral Carpets were of a number of bands from the Greater Manchester area to have success during that period. The Charlatans being another, who were also deemed to be part of the cultural movement dubbed Madchester. We're going to talk about Life, but there's, you know, the build-up to Life I'm interested in,
yeah, totally,
as well. And, you know, the formation of the band and, like, when it all started and the EPs and, yeah, you know, the... Yeah, just yeah, all cool. of it, really.
We go back a long way. We both our band and Tim's band, we sort of met. You were right at the start of your band. I think we'd been together a couple of years before that.
But yeah, yeah.
We were very much thrown into the same scene at the end of 89, early 90, wasn't it?
Yeah. The only one I know going to the charts the week after This Is How It Feels.
It was definitely Top of the Pops. Top, kind
yeah,
of like
spring.
We weren't on Top of the Pops at the same time,
no,
but we were definitely. You're on 1 week. We were on the weekend.
Yeah,
that kind of
which
thing.
Which followed hot on the back of Happy Mondays and Stone Roses being on the same edition back in. I think it was in the November '89. That would have been, I think.
Yeah.
So really, things were. You know, as a kid growing up watching Top of the Pops, you see these bands that you like Echo and the Bunnymen and early U2 getting onto Top of the Pops. It felt like that was the new era 10 years on or
yeah,
7 years
yeah,
on.
Yeah, definitely.
And we were involved in it, you know, so it's kind of like a bit of an eye-opener, really, and exciting.
Yeah.
It was a dream come true as well, because it's like in our circle of, our social circles, everybody wanted to be a pop star. You know yeah. what I mean? That was like from being... 8, 9, 10 year old, that'd be top of your list, you know what I mean? Pop
yeah.
star, and then if that don't work, I'll be a vet, in my case.
I like to rewind, though, to, like, you know, Plane Crash and
yeah.
And I guess pre-Tom.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Train surfing.
Yeah, so that, nutshell then, so Graham started the band with Steve, the
yeah.
original singer, who's now the current singer. Back in, as far as the early 80s, 82, 83?
It's 86 when there was a bit of an incarnation of the band in the very early 80s.
Very
but
early
it
80s.
Kind of all slipped. People got interested in drinking and females
yeah.
and
yeah.
driving, and the band kind of slipped away. But I kind of kept it going with anybody who was around. And I bumped into Steve at an indie disco in Oldham at a place called The Moor End, which was a Monday night, and they played like, it was like John Peel, but in a disco, the
yeah,
stuff
yeah,
that John
yeah,
Peel
yeah.
had played. And there wasn't an awful lot of people there, but it was a great little scene. And
yeah.
I remember chatting to Steve, and I used to play football with Steve back in the 70s. And I said, oh, you know, I was in a bit of a band, but everyone's gone separate ways. And he said, I'll come and do some singing. So me and Steve started as a duo. And then we went through a whole host of drummers and bass players.
Yeah.
And by 87, you had wheeled your organ into the practice room, hadn't you?
Yeah, yeah. Well, we had a mutual friend, so I think it was Chris Goodwin.
Yeah.
Who was a drummer in a little band. I had me, Chris and Manny had a band called The Mill from 84 through to
yeah,
85,
yeah.
early 86.
Yeah.
And Chris told me, because I had a little studio, a little recording studio in Ashton,
yeah.
which is a suburb of Manchester. And it was on the ground floor of a cotton mill. And I had this little recording set up, very basic four-track cassette sort of system. And bands used to come in, and I'd record the demos for them for like £3 an hour
oh,
or something.
So you're a bit of a dab hand at the desk.
I was like
a
very poor man's Joe Meek.
That's great. That's still pretty
Joe
amazing.
Meek,
without the controversy.
Yeah. But So bands used to come and I'd produce demos and they'd rehearse sometimes in a little room out there. But Chris called me up and said, there's this band that they've heard you to Challa Grid recordings or something.
Yeah.
And they're interested in coming down and you doing a demo with them.
Oh, great, great.
And I said, what are they called? And he said, In Spiral Carpets. And I laughed. I said, that's a crap name. No, anyway, but within a couple of days, they came down and recorded a demo and I basically just fell in love with this music. It was like raw. It was garage. It was like, it's punk, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Punk is very much where my music journey started,
yeah,
you know,
in
76, seeing the Pistols, which I was fortunate enough to do. Early in Spirals, it was like, it had that energy, that punkiness of Buzzcocks, and there was no keyboards on it at the time. So I did a couple of demos for them. They started doing a bit of rehearsing there, and then one night I spoke to Graham, and I said, how about if I bring this organ in? I've got this Farfisa organ that I've had for a while, and I think if I play this with you lot, it'll sound like The Seeds or Jefferson Airplane or Question
Mark.
Yeah,
that's how you sold it to me, because you said that Pink Floyd had one and the first album, so right away I was hooked. I was sold.
And I remember me and Graham, like, literally wheeling this organ in, like a massive fridge sort of thing.
Yeah.
And Craig looking like, he didn't say it, but you could tell he was thinking, what's going on here? What's all this about?
And here we are.
Yeah. And because I knew the songs, I had like a few very basic riffs. But after punk, it was like a lot of kids, growing up in the 60s and early 70s, you'd see Top of the Pops and you'd listen to albums and you had to be a good musician, you know, to be in some of these bands. It's like even bands like The Sweet, they were great musicians, somebody like me from Oldham who sounds like this and had no musical ability whatsoever was never going to be in a band. It just wasn't on our radar, even though you all dreamed of it.
Yeah.
And then punk was like, these are kids like me from streets around here, like, you know, Steve Diggle at the Buzzcocks. I was at college with his brother, Phil.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're suddenly looking at kids.
We've had Diggle on here.
Right?
Yeah.
Legend. But it's like just, you suddenly see these people that are carved out the same block of wood as myself and Graham. And you realise that, you know, we can do this now. And that's at that moment, I dropped out of art college right away and I started just collecting anything that made noise, you know, music, whether it was little, you know, Bon Tempe drum machines or little electric organs, microphones, just started collecting junk and filled my house with it. And part of, you know, my gear was this Farfisa organ that I'd bought off some guy in London for 120 quid out of the small lads at the back of the Melody Maker.
Wow.
So I had this, a lot of gear, which is why I ended up building a little studio to use it in. And yeah, the rest is history. These guys could turn up to record and next thing, I'm in a band.
Yeah.
It's time to kick off a listening party with a song. Let's play track one from Life. It's Real Thing. Talk about Life.
Yeah, that's
why not?
Yeah.
So, track one.
Yeah.
It's just called Real Thing. So, yeah, it kind of has a bit of a thing before it kicks in, doesn't it?
It's actually me playing the bass notes on the Farfisa.
Right.
And it's not, it sounds like a sequence, but it's me playing it live.
Yeah.
And I think when we played it live, we played it for quite a long time, didn't before anything happened. And some days, I'd be there, sat there, my hand would be really sore, and I'd be thinking, come on, you buggers.
Or just waiting for Craig to stick us in, which sometimes he took a while to do that, didn't he?
But I think, I like the anticipation, even now, when I listen to that intro.
It's a good intro. It's a good first track, isn't it? Good intro.
And I like to think it sort of symbolises how, at the time, there was a lot of anticipation around our records coming out,
of course. I was wondering whether you'd signed to mute at this point while you were recording, or
not when we'd recorded.
We recorded.
We were having this discussion on the way down on the train that when we recorded the Life album, we didn't have a record deal.
Yeah,
we paid for it all. The recordings were paid for, as far as I remember, from gig money and T-shirt money, merchandise.
I was going to go into that as well,
because we were quite well known at the time for being this little cottage industry that were putting out these cow T-shirts and cassette tapes we were selling.
Yeah.
We bootlegged our own first single. The Plane Crash EP, we eventually put out another 5,000 copies of it or something.
Yeah, I can't remember how many, but yeah, we're definitely...
But we're always like scheming to bring money in, and that money paid for the recording of the album that you're about to hear.
I was talking about to Graham about New Mountain Street as being like the analog internet of Manchester in the late '80s, early 90s.
I've been writing about New Mount Street this week.
Yeah, fantastic.
And it's like, I think it doesn't get enough credit for the importance. The Hacienda and Factory get, you know, credit deserved. True. New Mount Street was a building, probably the first of its kind in Manchester.
So SJM.
Yeah, SJM.
Bop City.
Red Alert. Yeah, Bop. Yeah. Notorious T-shirts in the bottom.
And
Chemical Brothers.
Yeah, that's Chemical right. Brothers. Yeah, later. Yeah. I mean,
Brian Cannon.
I went to meet Alison Martin there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Microdot, who did Brian Cannon, who did Oasis Leaves, he was in there.
Yeah.
Wow. To people who don't know, it was called 23 New Mount Street. It was an old mill just outside the city centre of Manchester. And there was just a lot of artistic units in there, mainly music kind of related things. But
it was an incredible place, that.
It was.
Yeah, it was. Just like mind blowing. When I think back, that there's a guy called John Lancaster that started it.
Yeah.
He was the guy, the brains behind it. And I think he deliberately set up a place that would bring all the creatives together.
Yeah.
And it was like literally like three or four stories. Sunset Radio was up there.
Yeah.
The first community radio in the UK. This one building on the edge of Manchester City Centre in 1989, everyone was in there.
Yeah.
It was just incredible.
Yeah.
But driving the T-shirts around, Mark Collins from Future Charlatans.
Yeah.
You played on his album, didn't you?
On the Wall Tones. I did a bit of five or six tracks on the Wall Tones' first album.
The Deepest, wasn't it?
The Deepest, yeah. Everybody was helping each other.
Yeah,
yeah. You know what I mean? It was a very generous scene. It wasn't, you know, my memory of it wasn't like, oh, they got on Top of the Pops before us. It wasn't like that. It was like, great, the Roses have done Top of the Pops. That means we'll probably do it with This Is How It Feels, which we did a few weeks after or whatever. Yeah. So it was all very... a great supportive community, and I think it still is Manchester. It's still very much like that.
I remember you coming to see us at the Academy and sort of like telling us what to do and what not to do.
Yeah.
So you had a few years on us, you know, of like releasing records. And
I remember I think the first time I heard you lot was Indian Rope would have been the first.
Oh yeah, that was good, yeah.
And it was getting played, from what I remember, before I heard it on radio, I heard it in Eastern Block on the weekends, like the end of 89. It was like, it just seemed to be on in there a lot.
Wow.
And like, being a keyboard player, I'm listening, thinking, hang on a minute, yeah. There's some new kids on the block.
Yeah. Oh, good.
With an organ.
Oh, good. I like that.
You know what I mean? But again, brilliant.
But that's what I liked about, you know, your organ.
Yeah.
The kind of the attack on it.
Yeah.
Right. I guess, like, I mean, Rob played with attack.
Yeah.
Because he's kind of an angry guy.
Well, it was the Hammond. He played the Hammond. But yeah, that's like hearing the Charlatans for the first time and thinking, this is what we need, more.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember having a conversation with Rob once at a gig, and we were backstage, and we were chatting, we got talking about how keyboard players should always sit down when they're playing. It's not right. If you don't have a standing up keyboard player, it's not right. You know what I mean? Sit them down.
There's some certain rules, isn't there? I don't know if you've been sent through
with your discussions band. About this. Yeah.
With the, don't have your guitar too high.
Too high,
unless you're from Liverpool. That's fine.
Yeah.
Don't have it too low unless you're in a goth band.
And if you're not the singer or backing singer in the band, don't sing. Don't sit there.
Don't sing along.
Don't mind along,
because you know the words.
Surely you've been through that with your band too.
I'm pretty sure we have. Yeah.
I'm only the bass player, but I know all the words. Look, don't do that.
No, nobody sing along. But it's a great time because it was like indie bands, like, for want of a better expression, to various genres of indie bands. Like, there was kind of like a certain ratio of kind of funky guitars on the early Happy Mondays records.
Yeah, definitely.
And then the dance thing came in the summer of, well, 89 for us, but it's the summer in 1990 where it became very cool to go to raves and the Hacienda and stuff. Yeah. But in the meantime, we were making records just like we'd always done and always tried to.
Well, you know, Mark Day wanted to sound like ACR, didn't he?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, he loved him.
Yeah,
it's great. I loved ACR.
Yeah.
I still did. But
yeah, great band.
They're phenomenal, aren't they?
Yeah, fantastic.
So, Real Thing as the opener then. Was it always going to be the opening track?
I think we spent more time as our career went on, spending time on the order of things, but it just really lends itself to be the first track
because of
the submarine noises at the beginning, and then the 1, 2, 3, 4, and we're all in.
Yeah.
It's quite upbeat.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember John Peel playing this on his show, which was great for me because he played our early singles and we'd been on in session as well. He played all our the first few singles, but for him to start the show with this, it meant that he was still on board. Because he never bought into the Storm Roses.
Yeah.
He played Happy Mondays, he played Yourselves.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
But it was good for me personally, from a personal point of view, that he was still into playing our music on his show and that we still seem relevant.
Yeah. Let's hear another track from Life. It's the second song, Song for a Family. Song for the Family.
So that was a song that I wrote, just a snapshot of a working class family, and yeah. It's saying, I think she's a lollipop lady, isn't she, the mum?
Yeah.
The dad's unemployed, he's sat in the pub playing dominoes.
Yeah.
The kid's a football fan, he's on the terraces at weekend opening. Yeah, yeah. And it's like, the bottom line is like, no matter who you are, you're praying for the same things, your family's all right and you've got work, and you know, yeah. That's just a very simple working class snapshot, really, of a family. And I've always thought in my head it's the same family that are in This Is How It Feels as well. I've only just realised that the consecutive tracks are
straight after each other. Yeah,
I didn't realise that, but yeah, it's the same family.
It's leading up to it. It's like
exactly how we created it. We said real things going to be first.
And then the lollipop woman was directing traffic the track afterwards.
Oh, yeah, there's a doubt.
Give over.
Wow.
Who'd have thought it? Or was it the son who got into drugs and stood in the middle of the road directing traffic? Is that what it was?
That's bizarre. I didn't realise that those three were the same. But yeah, Song for the Family. It's to me one of my favourite songs we've done, and we did an instrumental version called Tune for a Family.
Yeah.
Which was used, on TV for some sort of... Granada used it for some driving through the city centre. I think musically, something I'm quite proud of. As a band, I think.
Yeah,
it's like,
quite dozy.
Yeah. Quite dozy, isn't it?
Yeah.
I was
thinking it was kind of quite Stranglers-y as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that would be quite dozy, wouldn't it, as well?
Yeah. The Stranglers are all over. You know, it's everywhere, keyboard-wise, there's a lot of
Dave Greenfield.
And even now, like bass, you know, Martin tries to get his bass sounding as much like JJ Benelli as he can.
Of course.
You know, make it growl and make it...
It's either JJ or Hockey, I suppose.
Yeah. And I think Hockey was a massive JJ fan, wasn't he?
Yeah, I imagine, yeah. So, well, yeah, Song for Family. It's great to hear that again. And then This Is How It Feels. Just sounds fantastic. I sang that with you the other day.
That's right. You did a good job as well.
It's brilliant. It was great. It was good that you joined us on stage for This Is How It Feels at Kendall. It was a great moment for us.
It was good for me too.
Yeah.
I read that all great psychedelic singers are 5'10".
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I felt quite confident walking onto the
stage. Are you 5'10"?
Of course, yeah.
Let's not tell 6 foot 2 Steve.
But I was thinking, you know, Rocky Erickson.
Right.
Thought that'd be quite good to mention Rocky Erickson in this interview, and Damo Suzuki.
Was he 5'10" as well?
Oh yeah.
You could just, nobody's going to check, are they?
No, probably not. Sid Barrett. So
back to this album then.
But from your first big hit.
Yeah.
This Is How It Feels.
Yeah.
What was leading up to this? Did you feel like you had something? Was it kind of like, you know, was it... You know, tell us about the video. Tell us everything.
Or the video.
We've always written, like, we've always had more than one writer. You know, at one point, well, now we've got 5 writers in the band at the moment. So we were writing gentle songs at the same time as we were writing these mad garage records.
Yeah.
You know, songs occasionally, like Sun Don't Shine was a beautiful gentle
And we'd
record.
Have Move out as a single in late
89. Yeah. Was Move before this one?
Move came out in November. Around the time the Roses and Happy Mondays did Top of the Pops, Move came out around that time.
And then Joe was the single before that, was it?
It was, or maybe a couple of singles.
A couple of singles before that. I remember, I bought Joe.
Yeah.
That was brilliant. That song.
Move, I think Move came out, was it Joe, Find Out Why Move?
Or? Oh, Find Out Why, yeah. That's right. Okay, that's great.
But Move got to like 41 in the charts, I think.
And that was on Mute, was it? Was that on Mute?
No.
So it was straight after that you signed to Mute, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So we got to 41 in the chart. If it got to 40, we'd have been the first Manchester band on Top of the Pop. So
that's amazing.
And that would have been a couple of months before the Roses and the Mondays.
A couple of weeks. Yeah. Just a little.
But
bit
it was like
before.
It was. You could see the signs were there. Yeah. This music we were making with our contemporaries, including yourselves.
Yeah.
It was only a matter of time before this went mainstream and top 20, which it did, obviously.
Yeah.
it was a great time, dead exciting and fond memories for me. You're just like,
yeah,
one of the happiest times of my adult life was.
So it was all leading. It was all leading up to this.
Yeah,
and then the next single.
Well, This Out of Fields was the first one that got in the 40, was it?
Yeah,
yeah. And we did Top of the Pops the first time with it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was at a time when, did you have to do a live vocal or was
no,
it? It was mimed.
We did it twice. Like, we did it the first week. It went in the charts. Then it went up again, and then we did it the third week, if you like.
It was a bit of a turning point for us because it was like, you know, doing Top of the Pops the first time was like,
it's amazing. You know, who was on at the time?
Not Snap or Snap. Delight, maybe.
Ooh. Delight.
There was a lot of dance. Every time we did Toppy and them.
Toppy.
Every time we did Top of the Pops back then, you'd have this weird mishmash of styles and genres.
Course,
so
yeah.
We did it one time in Delight, were on it.
Yeah.
The first night we did it, Primal Scream were on it doing Loaded.
Yeah, you're all pulled together from whatever you've been doing. Like, we had a musical history. You'd be on there with, there was a band called Business.
That's right,
doing
yeah.
their Party Line single.
Yeah.
You've never heard of them before. You'll never hear of them again. But you've just all come together on that half an hour programme. You'll have seen it yourself.
Yeah,
we're steeped in the history of Top of the Pops and we've grown up watching it and stuff. And then you'd have these people coming in who probably didn't even know what Top of the Pops meant
that's
to
true.
Some people.
Yeah, that's true.
But we're all there in the same room. We'd have some interesting conversations with, like when we did it with Marky Smith, I Want You, and he was having a bit of a ruck with Elvis Costello. You know, you get involved in that. And it's you end up having a conversation with somebody who you've only ever heard about or seen on TV before, and it kind of makes you realise that they actually do exist and they do have problems or they are a bit madder than you are. You know, it's quite interesting.
Going back to the song that sort of feels it, that was the moment when the success of that meant that we no longer had to explain to our parents that we are doing the right thing. You know what I mean? It was like, it was a bit of a, because Top of the Pops was the epitome of success in pop music. But you know, if you did Top of the Pops back then, that was like, you were succeeding.
Let's play a track. Track 3 from Life. This is Inspiro Carpets with This Is How It Feels on Absolute Radio.
Seems they found him under a train, and yet he had it all on a plate. So this is how it feels to be lonely. This is how it feels to be small. This is how it feels when your word means nothing at all.
That was This Is How It Feels, the third song from Life by Inspiral Carpets.
Yeah.
Saddleworth Moor was the video, place for the video, wasn't it?
It was a Snake Pass.
Oh, yeah. Well. Okay.
Yeah.
And that was it in the January of...
Yeah, it was freezing.
1990.
Like, we were trying to wear our normal, you know, clothes that we normally wear at the time, but we were underneath, it was like wrapped up to... I remember having bags on inside of my baseball boots because it was, we were walking across a boggy moor and stuff like that, and it was January, so it was only light for about 10 minutes.
And there'd been blizzards through the night. There was actually vehicles that had crashed off the road into the ditches, so there's abandoned vehicles along the Snake Pass. And we are there on this moor, and it was leathering it down, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was cold.
It looked cold.
We had a van, like, I think it was a catering van that was doubling as a dressing room.
Yeah.
And didn't one of the staff get hit by the door because the door it opened in the wind and it knocked some down.
Tarpaulin blew off and got it past this guy from Sheffield was bringing some pies to us. And this tarpaulin, like, I saw it out the van window. Tarpaulin come off the crosswind, took this tarpaulin off the back of a truck and smacked this guy across the face. And he's rolled, and he was holding these pies, and he opened the door and goes, "I've got you some pies." And he had all this whiplash on his face.
Oh my God.
I remember Mike said, "Shut that door, will you? It's freezing in here." And but he'd just been whipped by this tarpaulin coming off the sheet. But it was freezing. I don't know why we did it there. I don't know why we couldn't have recreated that in some sort of studio. You know, it was a whole new ball game, wasn't it?
Did it feel like, you know, a lot bigger?
Like when you look back now, you're thinking, "Oh, like that was stupid," or "We should have done that a bit better," you know. But you know, any band when you're on your first album run, you're just excited, aren't they? And the world's your oyster, you know. And then before you know it, you're 20, 30 years down the line, and a few members have fallen off along as you go. And you know, here we are today, you know, looking back, reminiscing, which is fantastic because for this album to still be relevant now is brilliant.
But, yeah.
It's a rocky road, very, very enjoyable, but it is a rocky road getting getting along. That's what we were just saying on the way down, that bands like U2 and Coldplay still got the same lineups after 30 years. Whatever you think of the music, you've got to take your hat off to that.
Yeah.
But it is mad, isn't it, when you think about it? When we do gigs these days, we're all on the same bus, band and crew. You know, and it is like a, what do you call it, a pub on wheels.
I hope my wife's not listening.
And, you know, we go out and have a good time and enjoy it.
Unit's brilliant, isn't it? The chemistry and the team, it's just, we all go out together, you know, we've got food together, crew, band, you know, it is very much a family. And some of them are, like the guy that's selling our shirts, Dave Brad. He was the same age as me, pretty much.
Yeah.
I've known him since we were 16, 17 on mopeds. You know, we met through mopeds and motorbikes. And he's been a very successful businessman. He's retired. He doesn't need to do this, but he chooses to come and travel with us and sell our shirts. Wow. And he does it with passion. He's brilliant at it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's my old mate from being a teenager, you know. Going back to the video for This Out Feels, we eventually released that as a single in America. And the American label, Elektra, was it Mute with Elektra?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They insisted that we did a better video.
I've had that before.
So we did one in the style of Gilbert and George, the artists.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's still this like soap opera, this family kitchen sink drama, but in the style of Gilbert and George.
It's funny how you do your thing and you get to a certain level of success in the UK, and then when the Americans look at what you're doing, they try to change it to enhance it, when really you've made your success by being what you are and what you've done, they try to change it.
We've had that. Like Weirdo did a video for Weirdo, and
I think you play the game. We were just glad to be in the industry and making records and traveling the world. You know, so if somebody says, you know, you need to do a different video for this, we weren't going to argue. We'd go along with it.
Yeah, we did it twice, and then I think a third time it was like, no. Let's hear the next one from Mike, Direct in Traffic. Directing Traffic, that felt like a song that you were playing a bit before the album. Is that right?
I reckon that was in the set.
Yeah, well, we did Directing Traffic on the other side of midnight with Tony Wilson.
After
Steve had left, which would have been Jan 89, and before Tom joined, which was Feb 89, we did Directing Traffic as an instrumental without a singer.
First ever TV.
And wasn't that advertising for a singer? Weren't you saying you were looking for a singer?
Not deliberately. We Tony had asked us to do the show
because
he'd met Noel and Craig at an house party somewhere, apparently.
Yeah.
And when they mentioned the Spirals, Tony said, let's get you on the show the other side of midnight. So we had it all lined up. It's in the diary. And then Steve announced he was leaving the band. So we contacted Tony and said, look, thanks for the invite, but our singer's gone. We're going to have to cancel it.
Yeah.
And Tony Wilson, in true Tony Wilson style, just said, come and do an instrumental.
Yeah, fantastic.
How cool is that? That's great. You can imagine there can't be many people in that chain, Granada TV, and that would have just thought that was all. He just said, just come and do an instrumental. Yeah.
Brilliant, really. Yeah. This is the sort of thing you never forget, like John Peel first ever played the first single playing Crash, and Tony Wilson having us on the programme doing an instrumental without a singer was real big moments for us.
And it's great when you see really like enigmatic performance and, you know, starts at one pace, but by the end of it, we've sped up.
Yeah,
I don't know what we weren't very professional, were we?
But it's a great
performance.
TV,
and then at the end of it, that's when he said Tony came on and said, "That's in Spiral Carpets, looking for a singer, but doing all right in the meantime."
And then
a few months after, by then we'd got Tom singing, and we got back in touch with Tony and said, "Right, get back on," and we went on and did Sackville with Tom singing. Right. And it was phenomenal, and you know
that felt like that was the rave, the summer of love for us, which was June 89, which was a year before the Manchester year, if you might say. But there was like loads of raves going. They had a rave at Granada TV.
That's right. I think I was out of town, but I remember that. But it's funny, like you mentioned, like that. You know, we were doing our indie band stuff or garage band stuff, psychedelic. You had the raves going on, But everybody was listening to the Pixies. Everybody had the Pixies album.
Yeah, they did, yeah.
Everybody had the De La Soul album.
Yeah, and so Delight, like, you know.
To say that Manchester's remembered for, you know, yeah, whatever.
De La Soul were big in Manchester, weren't they? I mean, they played a lot.
If you had the Roses album and the Mondays album, you would definitely have had the Pixies and De La Soul as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
It was like they just, so like multi-genre taste, you know, we were all just celebrating a lot of different kinds of music, you know.
Yeah.
I was going to come and audition for Inspiral.
Yeah, but I've heard that over the years, because some people said...
I was a day late.
Right, okay.
Yeah, so I decided that I was going to go and... Because I'd heard that, like, Chris Griffiths was auditioning.
He was meant to come, but didn't turn up.
He didn't turn up. So there's, you know, it's like, you've got to go. And it's like, okay, I'm going to go. And then, so I'd been to work and I was going to go it's vague, but then this guy, Steve, said, oh, they found somebody. So
that's weird, because I didn't realise it was Chris Griffiths, because we knew Chris as being... What was he on the scene? He wasn't even managing bands or anything. He was just around, wasn't he?
He was always at International 2.
Was he with the Paris Angels or the Denton lot?
Yeah,
he Adch could and all
been.
That?
He could have been, but he was always at International 2.
But we liked the way he looked.
Yeah.
And I think we said we should ask that Chris to come in. And I don't even think we knew if he could sing or not.
No, you used to call him Mr. Magoo for some reason. I don't know why.
He didn't wear glasses out, did he?
I don't think so. But I know Chris. I know him to this day. He's a good guy, Chris. Really funny guy. Funny, big, successful tour manager.
Can you imagine that if you'd have come in an audition?
I know.
You would have got the gig, obviously.
Well, Noel didn't.
Yeah, Noel didn't get it. You know, we should mention that. So Noel Gallagher was the first person to audition to sing for us.
Yes.
So we knew him as a fan of the band. He was coming to the
gig.
But
was he your roadie anyway?
Not at that point.
Not at that point.
No, he was just a fan. And we knew him, a cheeky little chap. He wasn't a roadie. No, but the night he auditioned, he wasn't. He auditioned and we said, we decided, look, we really like him.
Yeah.
His voice doesn't suit what we're after.
Right.
But let's bring him in and let him work with us. Yeah. So he got the job.
He had been hanging around with us because he first came in June 88.
Right.
I first met him in May 88.
Yeah.
That
I know he's on the scene. I know he was coming to the gigs because he came on crutches, didn't he, with his leg plaster. Yeah. But he used to work for British Gas. He had like a little watchman job at the end, in between the Hacienda and the Boardwalk. There used to be a British Gas storage yard.
Yeah.
And he had the job sitting in a shed all day to stop people nicking stuff.
Right.
Everything got nicked, obviously. But he came on one day, broke his leg because a pipe had fell on it at work, I think. Was the story. So we knew him. And like when it became obvious we were going to find a new singer, he was the first one through Craig. He sent a message in saying, want to audition.
Yeah.
We auditioned him. And like I say, he could sing. He was a singer.
Had a good haircut as well, didn't he?
Yeah, he grew his hair into the right shape.
Yeah, when we first met him, he had a massive quiff, Morrissey.
Yeah.
Massive big monobrow going right across.
Yeah, he gets called out. He wasn't just a roadie, he was with us day in, day out
for
4 years, nearly 4 years. Yeah. And that's
were you rehearsing at the Boardwalk at the time? Or
not at the time, but we ended up at the Boardwalk. Right. When he was with Oasis, we sacked him very amicably. We sacked him because it was like...
If you could ever sack anybody amicably.
Yeah, we gave him 2,000 quid, didn't we? That's quite amicable, isn't it? He didn't have a contract out, but we gave him a load of money and said, knew his heart wasn't in being with us anymore. This is like end of 92. So he joined his brother's band at this point. They changed the name to Oasis.
Yeah. Were you at that Boardwalk gig?
We were at his first gig with Oasis. I think we were at a gig where he stood watching Oasis with us before he was in it.
Right.
Is that right? There was one gig where...
They played there loads in the early days. I remember seeing him.
I definitely saw him do his first gig with Oasis on the Boardwalk.
Yeah, I was there, yeah.
But I've got a feeling there's another one where he was watching Oasis with us. I might be wrong, but... But anyway, so, but by the end of it, he didn't want to be plugging our equipment in Estonia or whatever. He wanted to be writing his songs and working with his band, so...
Yeah, fair enough.
His heart wasn't in the Inspirals, and we just amicably sacked him.
Yeah.
There's no nice way of saying that, is there, really?
You know, he's a great part of the team at the time.
Yeah.
And he still gives us a lot of credit for... I've heard him say, not just to me, but to other people, that period working with us was the happiest time of his working career.
Yeah.
Because he didn't really get any stress, he didn't get any headache, he was just having the time of his life, we were paying him well,
yeah.
Travelling the world, you know, we were looking after him. And he, you know, he went from that to being an Oasis, which, albeit massively successful, it was a lot of stress for him, a lot of pressure. But yeah, it was, you know, he joined us. He wanted, you know, when he came to us, he wanted to be our singer. Yeah. He had songs. We knew he was a singer. Yeah. So it was obvious that eventually that was going to be his world, you know what I mean? So he did Whiskey. Yep. So a song called Whiskey, which I'd written before I joined the band, and it was written from the point of view of a load of what we used to call beer monsters. So Noel's singing it at this audition, and he gets about 30 seconds in and he stops. He just says, "Who's written this? This is absolutely, this is totally sexist." And he said something like that. Yeah. And I'm like, "One of mine, but let's move on." Let's try this next one. But somewhere there'll be a tape of that rehearsal, because I recorded everything in that mill. It was my rehearsal studio. So somewhere there'll be a tape of it, I'm sure.
Besides Me from Inspiral Cabot's first album, Life, on Absolute Radio. That's another upbeat one.
Yeah, quite fast.
Yeah,
always
great.
Reminds me of a bit like the Wedding Present meets New Order, because it's got a very New Order melody to it to me. We probably haven't played it live since 1990, I reckon. Yeah. But it was good track
at
the time.
I like it.
You know?
I liked it a lot.
I always like playing it. It's good.
I like there's a moment where I think we must have been listening to the same records. There's a moment that sounds, you know, it's like the Charlatans have definitely got from that song, either that song or something else.
Yeah.
It's like the
And
it reminded me of Everything's Changed, which is like the B-side of The Only One I Know.
Right.
So exactly the same time.
Yeah.
1990.
One of our brand new songs, Tim, has got a very Charlatans feel to it.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good. I mean, it's all...
Is it called Truth Hurts or something?
Yeah, it sounds like Stones, the kind of
Spencer
Olympic
Davis.
Studio Stones, Charlatans.
Yeah. Oh, good.
We had another one on the last album that was very Charlatans. It wasn't it? Forever Here or Here Forever, whichever way around it.
Yeah, that was
very Charlatans.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just, when you've been around for such a long time, you do end up influencing
your
fellow band.
We all bought Joe.
Yeah. I mean, that was a very groundbreaking single, because we did that with 808 State, Square One Studios in Bury. They produced it. Now, it was one of our conventional songs with a key change in it, but when we added 808 State to it, which it didn't change massively, but it just became, it just brought those two genres of music, dance and indie, just that little bit closer together, didn't it?
Yeah,
like
I
Stone
get that.
Roses records did, records did, like yours did as well. A lot of boundaries were broken down, even from the early days of us starting our band in 86 or whatever, where we were out and out indie and we didn't know about Public Enemy or the Beastie Boys. But you get a 14-year-old drummer and you're in your mid-20s and you're going to take on new influences.
Yeah,
and then
there's
other bands doing similar things dotted around the country, you know, so... And quite a few of them in Manchester.
Yeah. We both share the loss of our drummer.
Yeah. Tragically.
Big moment. I went to the funeral. I saw you speak at the funeral back in, was it 2012?
2013.
Very sad. I thought you spoke very well at the funeral. Something we hadn't been through at the time.
Yeah.
We lost a member for another reason, not to death, but something we went through ourselves, like what would it be, three years later. And I don't know how you felt at the time, but we certainly thought we'd never play again. There would be a time where we hadn't been in the room together for years after Craig had passed, because it probably too many vivid memories of somebody from our gang has gone, you know. I don't know if you felt the same.
Well, with Rob, we were in the studio in the afternoon and then at night it was gone.
That
was like a real sort of, like, you know, just affected the body, you know.
But with
John, it was you know, he had a long suffering process, and he asked if we could use Pete Salisbury His choice while he recovered, and it just, he didn't feel like he was just taken from us at one moment. It was like a 5-year thing.
Yeah,
you know, that we all kind of all knew it was going to happen.
So quite the opposite from
quite Rob. The opposite from Rob. Completely, yeah. It's like so extremely opposite. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. With Craig, we were in the middle of recording an album, which has since just been shelved, and we'd been together a couple of weeks before.
Mm-hmm.
It's a massive shock, and it, probably same for you. I can remember where I was when I got the news, when I got the phone call. You know, and you just don't want to believe what your ears are, you know, what's going in, and just shocking. I don't know.
It's funny that when you start a band, there's things that you dream of and things that you expect.
Yeah,
but stuff like that's just not part of it, is it? You don't, you know, when you teenagers from Oldham or in your early 20s, you don't dream about any of us dying, or you don't think about it.
We just think you're going to live forever.
And then suddenly, you know, it's like, it's you know, everything changes. And it's with us, it was when Craig went, we didn't even discuss it. I think over the following months, we just all decided that's it, it's finished. You know what I mean? That's my recollection of it personally, was just don't want to do it now, that's it, it's done. Yeah. Put a line right under that. There.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I definitely had those feelings.
Yeah. Yeah. And then it was like 5 or 6 years later, 2022 maybe, yeah. September 2022, I get an email off Graham one Saturday morning. Graham emailed me, Steve, Martin, saying we've been approached, do we want to tour with the Mondays next spring?
Oh, wow.
No mention of money.
Yeah.
Just, do you want a tour supporting the Mondays? And I was like, it was a Saturday morning, I was like, started tingling.
Yeah.
Showed it to wife, and she's like, do it. I'm like, I want to do it. So it was just, it happened naturally, didn't it? It was like a very spontaneous process. Yeah. It's like we grieved for Craig, and you know, we helped his family best we could. We grieved for the band because that was over at the time, and then suddenly here's another chance. You know what I mean? So
when we came back in 22, when we started talking about it, and we did gigs in 23 and 24, Martin just wasn't quite ready, which, you know, we totally understood him. It must have been tough for him, and he was really straightforward and honest about it, that he didn't feel like the right time. And and he said, but you crack on, you know, if you want to do it, which we did. And Clint's son Oscar filled in on bass, and we also had Jake Fletcher, who's a friend of ours who plays with Paul Weller, both stood in on bass in Martin's absence. And then Martin's come back this year, and full credit to both Jake and Oscar, who really helped us process Craig's passing in their own way by helping us do the band again. And let's not forget Kev, who's filled Craig's shoes, who's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
But this year has been even extra special because Martin's come back. Yeah.
Let's press play on Many Happy Returns by Inspiral Carpets. Many happy returns.
Thank you.
Yeah, go on.
It's written about prisoner episodes, you know, the prisoner TV programme.
Oh, yeah.
That's nice. Written about that. I remember when we got back, when we'd been writing that song in out at the Blue Studios in Manchester, we got back to our office and said to our manager, we've done another song. And he goes, oh, what's it called? He said, Many Happy Returns. He goes, oh, that's rubbish. doing a birthday song. it's not that. But he wouldn't get, I don't think he was into the
prisoner. Did you have the soundtrack for The Prisoner?
Absolutely.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, got all the videos.
Yeah.
Then he got it on DVD when it came out on DVD. We were proper prisoner buffers.
Yeah. I mean, I used to get all the 60s sort of like soundtracks and Man from Uncle and stuff like that.
Yeah. The Prisoner was just, I don't remember it originally. I remember it from when they rerun it in 1983. And I remember a guy telling me at work when I was at the printer saying, oh, there's that weird sci-fi things on again. They're running it against that, called The Prisoner. And he was telling me about it. And I'm thinking, God, that sounds brilliant. And it was on the Mondays on Channel 4 at 10 o'clock, I think. So we didn't have a video then in those days. So I'd be just watching it. And some weeks I'd be taking photographs of the screen. Some weeks I'd just be recording bits of the soundtrack and stuff, you know.
Amazing.
But it was just, well, favourite TV programme, I reckon.
Definitely, yeah. Probably even now, there's a TV series, it's like, just nothing ever like it. Twin Peaks was good.
Twin Peaks is one for me. Yeah.
Well, going back to prison, I remember being on when it was on the first time round, but I was too young to watch it or appreciate it.
Were you fans of The Prisoners?
Yeah, they were one of the bands that I think we all united over. Because with any band, there's bands that Graham might like and I'm not keen on, or vice versa.
Yeah, same.
The Bunny Men were all into The Prisoners, totally.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they were
mad, right?
An inspiration, you know.
It's funny how they never really kind of took off to any real level because they were so influential. You didn't talk to Steve Lamacq about them yourselves.
Yeah, I speak to Steve about them.
Absolutely massive fans. Yeah. And yet they kind of, I saw him in Leeds at a place called Adam and Eve's, which holds about 200, and it was only half full.
I think I was there.
Was you?
It was about 86.
Yeah, 86.
And Graham had like a black polo neck on and a black cross around his neck, and a leather jacket, which I found on Camden Market.
I was there too.
I was there.
I think I might even have a live recording of that because I used to record all the gigs I went to. I used to bootleg them on my little cassette player.
Alex Stasko.
Absolutely. Call me the indie Alex Stasko.
So last year, you know, we got to support the prisoners at the roundhouse.
I remember,
and that was because they've been apart for years, haven't they?
Yeah.
We just got a random email, and it was literally worded, you know, sorry about the cheekiness of this email, but the prisoners are doing a gig at the roundhouse. You know, we'd be privileged to the Inspirals and support, and we're like, do it. Regardless of whatever mainstream success we might have had and they didn't. Without the prisoners, we probably would have been a different band, I think, you know, potentially.
Yeah. It's funny, all our crew, though, are a fair bit younger than us. They're all going, who's this band that you're playing underneath? You know, they've never heard of them, you know? Which I guess a few people in the, you know, fans might have been thinking the same as well, but for us, it was just fantastic to be on the same stage as them. And I mean, their albums are just, you know, they just said it all for us, really. Yeah, I mean, we wanted to sort of be that band.
Yeah. Yeah.
But with having Craig in the band, who was a fair bit younger than me and Clint, that he kind of stopped us going too much down that avenue because he had a big influence from hip hop, like Public Enemy and Beastie Boys and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So he kind of stopped us going too much down the prisoners. What
you need
might
that
call.
As well, don't you?
Yeah. Well, you know what? I always think about Birdland. Do you remember Birdland?
Yeah.
So they were going at exactly the same time we were starting to bubble.
Yeah, I remember. I like their hair.
They looked amazing. They had the ball heads. One week they'd have black ball heads. Next week they'd all be blonde,
bleach,
and dressed in white.
That's great.
But because they were 100% a retro looking band, you know, with all respect to them, I was a fan, but I think that's what probably held them back.
Right.
We had a great.
Do you think that's what happened with the prisoners as well, maybe?
Possibly, yeah. Like Graham says, Craig being the first one in the band to embrace hip hop music and then later on house music. And him being the one that was, you know, dressed head to toe in Adidas at 14-year-old. It meant that when people saw pictures of us, you'd have me that looked like I'd walked straight out of California in, you know, whenever, 1968 or whatever. Yeah. And then Craig, who looked like he could have been in the Beastie Boys. So we had that, we were as equal parts contemporary as we were retro. So I think that gave us a bit of longevity, I think, at the time, you know.
Definitely.
When I saw, I mentioned the Pistols in the Electric Circus. December 1976, and it was such an important. I knew in the moment it was my life was changing.
So is this the third time that they played?
It was the second time in Manchester. They did the Lesser Free Trade Hall in the summer, and then they did two gigs at the Electric Circus in December. So I was there on the 9th of December, and it was like I didn't have my camera with me.
Yeah,
mobile phones weren't a thing, obviously. Yeah. But I thought I've got to get some from this night, and I ripped a piece of red plastic off one of the stools. And I've still got it, saved it, you know, because I knew that I had to have something that I could hold that was in that room that night, you know what I mean?
They didn't have posters or didn't have
t-shirts? No, I ended up with an Anarchy poster, but I didn't get it on the night. But it was the bill was the Pistols, the Clash, Johnny Thunders and the Buzzcocks. £1.50 on the door. We didn't even buy tickets, we paid on the door.
Johnny Thunders was playing?
Yeah, Johnny Thunders was like one of the first gigs in the UK, I think, after the Dolls had split.
Wow.
But yeah, what a night that was. And you just think like, 50 years later, now nearly 50 years, and it's, you know, that's where my journey started there that night for me, you know. Yeah, incredible.
Let's hear the seventh track from Life, Memories of You.
Thank you.
Memories of You.
That, oh, that's a good one, yeah.
Bit of a nerdy fact. That was the intro of a song called You're Gonna Miss Me, not a cover version of the 13-foot elevator song. But yeah, that was a slow bit at the beginning of You're Gonna Miss Me. You're Gonna Miss Me didn't make it to the album, but the intro of it, Memories of You, did. Yeah. Which you then put some... you recorded a homeless drunk guy singing outside of the blue. Wasn't
so
it?
We recorded the album was recorded out of the blue in Ancoats.
Yeah.
And at the time, it was a pretty rough part of town.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like Graham was saying earlier, that he used to park his car outside, and in those days, you'd lift the bonnet up and take the alternator cover out.
Yeah, the alternator lead out.
So no one could take it.
It was like that part of the town. But at the side of the studio was a little bit of rough land, like where we'd park cars occasionally. But one day, we were doing a fanzine interview, and for some reason, we were using my dictaphone.
Yeah, yeah.
And while we were talking, while we were doing the interview, this guy came wandering along, this drunk, I assume homeless, but very drunk. And he started asking us what we're doing. And I started saying, I think he said, is that a theodolite?
Oh, yeah, that's where that came from.
No, it's a microphone, tape recorder. Anyway, so he started singing. When you have these memories. So I just give him the machine and he's holding it, singing into it. These memories of you in my heart, I always love you. So I had this random recording of this guy. And then at some point, when we started working on Memories of You, we decided to call it Memories of You after the lyric that this guy had sung.
Presumably that's an old song, Memories of You.
Must probably. I mean, he sung it
well. It's an old Irish song, you know, because it's a big, strong Irish community there on the round out of the blue.
Yeah. Well, that guy, whoever he is, he probably didn't realise it was on... He had his own track on a number two album.
Yeah.
You know, he got to number two, this, didn't he?
I don't think he'd care one hour.
Probably don't even know what an album is.
Gone now.
I like stuff like that because I think some of our best recordings have been when we've been a bit abstract and a bit gone off the track a bit. And it's like the stuff that I listen to now, it's like, wow, not many bands at that time could have pulled some of this off, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think. But, Memories of You is one of those tracks to me. It's like... It's also our most psychedelic.
Yeah, it's only short, isn't it?
Did you get a good rate out of the blue? To be able to sort of experiment and stuff like that.
I don't think we struggled to pay for it, did we?
Did you do some stuff like
that? No, but I just remember it being on, you know, tons of records and stuff.
Two guys that run it, a guy called Adam and a guy called Nick Garside, who produced our records.
Nick Garside, he produced the records, right?
He did most of the indie bands.
Clint's now going to do an impression of him. He had a dog called Max, didn't he?
Oh, Max, have you farted again? the studio stunk, though, because it was on the ground floor of this... building on Blossom Street, out of the blue. Blossom Street, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. On the ground floor, or in the cellar, in the basement, was an electroplating company.
Right.
Chrome plating, brass plating, all that. And to do that, you have big vats of, like, chemicals that stink, like methane or whatever. I don't know what it is they use, but... So this smell would always rise into the studio, so it always had this, like, really toxic sort of vibe anyway. Mm-hmm. And then because studios are sealed and all the walls are carpeted, I don't think they had air conditioning.
Yeah.
So you've got that natural sort of mustiness anyway.
Yeah, yeah,
and then you've got this bloody cocker spaniel that's farting its ass off all day. It just had a unique stink in it. But we used to love it in there.
Yeah, you'd come home and your clothes would smell of it, but it wasn't a bad smell. Like someone smoking or something, but just this, like, a cleaning product smell. Yeah. If I smelt it now, and I've not smelt it since
it'd throw me back.
I often thought they should change the name to Out of the Brown.
Yeah, I mean, Out of the Blue, it sounds so glamorous, you know.
Yeah,
it was to us. It was the epitome of success. We were there in this studio through the days, you know, recording through the daytime. Yeah. That was like a new thing for us, you know what I mean? Like, rather than just doing lockouts through the night and then going back to your day job or whatever in the early days.
We did that at Strawberry.
Yeah. I've just thought something happened. Out of the blue as well, that James were recording Goldmother in one of the other rooms. Tim was doing some vocals, and Clint, Tom, and Craig all sang backing vocals on the track Goldmother. Out of the blue, in the lounge area, out of the blue.
We were rehearsing in the rehearsal room, or in our little practice room in there.
All right.
There was a knock on the door, it's Tim.
Yeah.
And he just...
Do an impression of him.
Hey guys, would you like to come and sing backing vocals on the Goldmother? No, but he just...
That's a good impression.
Kindly invited us in. We did it. We went gold, 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 mother, gold.
Wow. Here's the eighth song from Life. She comes in the fourth. She comes in the fourth. She Comes in the Fall, which, if I remember rightly, was summer 90.
Like it was. Yeah.
It was New Order number one and...
Yeah, we
sort
did
of like that kind of times.
We did Top of the Pops.
World Emotion.
Yeah, we did Top of the Pops on the day that England lost to Germany on penalties in the World Cup in 1990, Italia 90.
I might have been watching that at the Windings.
Oh, right.
When we were recording some friendly.
Yeah.
That's written about Rosemary's Baby. You know the film with Mia Farrow in.
Yeah.
Which is filmed John in the Dakota Buildings, just on the edge of. New York Central Park, where John Lennon lived and was shot. And in the film, the guy who's the devil worshipper writes on a bit of paper saying, "She comes in the fall," about when a witch is going to return, and then just folds the paper up and puts it under Mia Farrow's door. And the pre-chorus bit, which says, "You should learn to walk, should learn to walk before you crawl," is a line from, do you remember a Liverpool band called The Room?
No.
They had an album that added that as the chorus line in the song, and I thought that's a great line to have in a song. So that was pinched from there. So thank you, The Room. We were quite an obscure Liverpool band.
Oh, yeah, no, I'll check
1982, out, John Peel band.
Wow, so like sort of Pale Fountains sort of time.
But yeah, it's been a long-standing live track of ours, that.
Yeah, it's a great one, that.
Yeah, it's probably really set we've ever done, I'm guessing.
And now we do a bit of a long drum outro. Did Craig used to do that? Kev's definitely.
I think Craig did it live.
Yeah.
And I think Kev's. Because Kev.
As a homage to Craig, maybe.
Kev was he knew Craig and he was a massive fan of Craig's work. Yeah. Mm. So with She Comes in the Fall, it's like it's a tribute to Craig. You know, obviously, we encourage it, and
so he does a big drum outro at the end every time we do it live.
Yeah, one of the things that Craig did with that track was, I mean, obviously we created the drum pattern, but it was Craig that suggested we get the marching girls in the video.
He suggested that, which
we did for the video, and it looked great. And then subsequently, you know, over the years we've got this marching troop to come and join us live on stage and that. But
did
that
you do that at G-Mex?
G-Mex. And that G-Mex performance, it's still online, it's still on YouTube.
Yeah,
21st of July. 1990, and it's still on. It's worth checking because the marching girls come out at the beginning of She Comes in the Fall, and then they all march off stage. We do the song, but when they come back out at the end, there's some missing because they fainted because of the 11,000 banks screaming at them. Wow. Do you know what I mean? It's a brilliant gig, that one.
That's great.
I watched it recently, and it's like we hardly said anything to the audience in terms of communication. There's hardly any connection, but the music, everybody was just bouncing, and we were just. Again, it was one of the peaks of our career, I think, the way we played that night.
It's amazing.
Yeah, we did a pre-production day the day before. We've been recording, haven't we? We've been recording the Island Dead EP in Dorking or somewhere down south. Yeah. And we came back to do a production day on the Friday. So we went through the set, and because we haven't played it for 10 days or so, because we've been in the studio, the rehearsal, we were rank, weren't we?
Yeah.
I went to bed that Friday night thinking, oh, God, that was terrible today. And we were spot on the day of the gig.
It happens a lot over the years, doesn't it? That's happened a lot. We've had the worst rehearsals, and then the next night we've done the best gig ever.
That's the point, though, when we came back, or we got to GMX for the rehearsal day, and there was just people working for us who we didn't even know they give us job titles like stage manager and production manager that we'd never had them before. We're thinking, well, what does that mean, stage manager? And like we were asking him, there's a guy called Pip, if I remember rightly, we had to ask him, we were asking him, could we go on stage, you know, like, well, we thought that's what you did. 11,000 people, it was a kind of a big turning point. And you also think as well is you just think it's going to go on forever and you're going to get even bigger, you know, when the likes of U2 and stuff, and as we said, Coldplay, and it doesn't always happen for everybody, does it? But you level out, and it's all about enjoying it, isn't it? And making the most of it.
I wouldn't change anything about our journey and our story as a band. You know, it's like I know a lot of bands that are far more successful, and you know, I'm a big fan of those bands, but I love our journey because we've achieved more than we ever could have dreamt of.
Yeah.
You know, I remember at the beginning thinking, I'd love to make a record.
Yeah.
Just want to make a record.
Yeah, you know, I'd love to be played on John Peel. And I'd love to be played on daytime radio.
I'd love to get on an aeroplane with this band. And it's like, before you know it, you're flying to Valencia to do a gig in 1987 or something with the Mondays and the Lars. And it's been great, and we're still here. We're still, you know, still enjoying it, and still making people happy, and still making good records.
I think signing to Mute was quite a big thing, and Martin really should take a lot of credit for that, because we were courted by a lot of record labels towards the end of '89, like Silvertone being one of them. CBS came at us, Sony came at us,
and we
had a chat with Mute, and I remember we sat around Daniel Miller's makeshift table in the boardroom, and Daniel Miller owned Mute and still does to this day, and he said to us, he said, "Oh, who've you been seeing?" And we said, "Oh, we've been to Sony and CBS," and he said, "Oh, so you're going to throw it all away then, this indie image that you have?" And we're all going, "Well, you know, we're going to make some money out of it, you know." But in the van afterwards, after we spent a couple of hours with him, Martin just piped up. It went a bit quiet, and Martin just said, "We should sign to Mute, you know, because we'll have artistic freedom."
Yeah.
And it's a bit of a cliche, and, you know, we all know the C87 bands and all that. Mighty Lemon Drops got signed, and the story is they lost a bit of the creative freedom.
Yeah.
It's a bit of stigma signing to others. But with Mute, they did just let us get on with it. They guided us in a good way and did let us get on with it, and could argue maybe had too much control about some of the choices of singles and stuff, but I'm the first one to admit that, you know, if I had the time again, we'd make a couple of decisions different from choices of single maybe, but it was great to make four studio albums on the same label with the same people.
No, it's great.
Yeah,
we had a similar thing with Beggars, really. Yeah. You know, everyone wanted to sign us,
yeah,
and we went with Martin Mills, and
yeah.
And we like the fact that we could get Pixies records, or, you know, Breeders album, throwing Muses and the Cult, just like the bands that were on the label, you know.
I think one of the things that appealed to us
about
the Mute roster at the time was Erasure, Depeche,
yeah,
Diamond and
Galas,
Zender Neue Barton, Nick Cave.
Yeah.
It was just this the most eclectic roster.
Oh, great label.
And then they wanted this Madchester band, and we were just thinking, like, if they're letting all them do what they do, that mad stuff, we're going to be fine, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was right when it was the right choice. And
plus, they had offshoots, Blast First, which had Sonic Youth, Dinosaur Jr.,
and the dance label. Yeah, we're still part of the Mute family.
That's good. This is Monkey on My Back by Inspiro Carpets on Tim's Listening Party. So that was in Spiral Carpets with Monkey on My Back. Yeah, I mean, the last sort of like four tracks are all like kind of racing, kind of big songs, fast.
Monkey on My Back, 2 minutes, 1 minute, 59 seconds.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a short one. That's quite an old song, dates back to, well, half of these songs, Tom sings on all of them, but on half of the songs we were doing with Stephen before Steve left and Tom joined. So Tom had the situation of learning the songs that were already existing, and I think Monkey on My Back had already been on Appeal Session. Sun Don't Shine went on to be on Appeal Session, but with Tom singing. Inside My Head, that's an old song, just kind of like teenage lads growing up, having girlfriends, partners, whatever. And falling foul of the trying to keep your life going, like your band and your football and your cricket angle, and balancing it with your romantic life and the problems that ensues.
Yeah.
Monkey on My Back is a drug phrase, though, isn't it?
I think it is, yeah.
I got the title from an Echo and the Bunnymen song.
Right.
The Monkey on My Back won't
monkey
stop
on my back, yeah.
laughing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
I think it is a drug term, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's not about drugs. It's about being up in the bedroom with a girl and it not being the right thing to be doing.
Oof.
No. Sun don't shine. Yeah, I mean, you can kind of tell that they're kind of not. You can't tell that they're early songs, but it makes sense that they kind of are.
Yeah, they definitely are.
Because it's a big race at the end. It's like, it's like really exciting.
Yeah, all them three songs all very similar. Just, you know, finding your feet in your life, kind of thing. Sun don't shine, obviously about lost love. You know, quite naive and quite twee, but It is good. Clint's keyboard on that is beautiful.
I think it's
absolutely
like
brilliant.
Quite velvety, isn't it? Yeah. The old thing, Sun Don't Shine, and a bit of a lost gem, because I don't think we didn't do it loads live, did we?
Sun Don't Shine. We did with Stay in the late '80s, yeah. But then not so much with Tom. I don't think we ever did it with Tom. We have done it since, because we did a live tour, didn't we? I've just remembered in 2013. So we have done it.
Did it then? Yeah.
Obviously back with Stay. Inside My Head. It's fast. It's short.
Yeah. It's the next track. Sun Don't Shine.
Something good we can't take away.
Absolute Radio.
Tim's listening party.
Inside My Head by Spiral Carpets on Absolute Radio. Tim Burgess here with Graham Lambert and Clint Boone for a listening party. And we're nearly at the end of this episode. The last song on the album is Sackville.
Which is the big...
epic.
Big epic, yeah. Which we did on the other side of midnight for Tony Wilson.
Yeah. It's a bit of a tasty place, right, Sackville?
It was basically, that's where we had our office at the time. Mm-hmm. When Tom joined the band, his partner, Alison, had a business on the second floor of one of the buildings on Sackville Street.
Yeah.
And we managed to blagged a bit of space to build an office in the corner. So that was our base for a couple of years after that.
Yeah.
So Sackville was literally, because it was a red light district in Manchester at the time. This is before it was like the village, as it's called now, Village. It's very touristy now, and it's a go-to destination for tourism. But back then it was rough, the only reason you went there was for sex, drugs or cheap rent in an office like the one we had, or in some cases all three probably, but... I don't know. Anyway, but it was just that again, a photograph. It was what I saw out of that window, over those weeks and months we were in there.
Big song.
Yeah, absolutely epic, yeah. And it's about the sex workers. That's what, at the heart of it, is that it's their story of what they were, what they were going through. And there's a murder at the end of it, which is based on a real life murder that was in the news at the time. So the song ends with that. So it's very much a photograph of what I saw at that window, we were sat doing our day today.
We were quite young when because we'd drive around there. Before we had that office, we'd drive around, as you say, in my Cortina, which is the same car parked outside out of the Blue Studios.
Yeah.
But when we're driving round, we wouldn't be taking the mickey and we wouldn't be after doing a deal with them. But it was just an eye-opener for these two lads from Oldham. I don't think you had ever seen anything like that before, where women stood on street corners. Prostitutes.
But it's funny
because we
had some amazing interactions with them, because they'd sit on the doorstep of the office. It was like a shared office building, 42, 44 Sackville Street, and they'd be sat on the office. You'd be having to walk round them to get into the office. And then I remember one night we were walking around flyposting in that part of town, and one of these girls was walking with us, telling us, "Stop it, you're going to scare my customers away." But proper, like, a lot of banter, a lot of get a proper haircut, get a proper job. It was like all that, It was like, there was a lot of, from my memory of it. So that's what that song's all about. It's an affectionate but dark view of, what was going on in that part of the world. And it's funny when you think how beautiful that part of town is now.
The building we're in, that 42 to 44 Sackville Street, it's like something you'd see on a New York kind of series somebody had have a penthouse flat or something. Beautiful old building. Fantastic.
Do you remember when the Strange Ways riots were happening?
Yeah.
So I think that wasn't long after we'd moved into that office. So they had the
New Main Street.
No, this is still Sackville.
All right. You couldn't see it from there, could you?
No, sorry, we didn't see it, but when they were on the roof, the prisoners protesting or whatever they were doing, we climbed up on our roof at the same, just to sort of mark the moment. So we did a photo shoot on the slates of our roof on Sackville Street, which is quite an iconic little picture when you see it now. But that was the same moment that they were on the roof over the other side of town, kicking off and shouting at people.
I remember.
And it was going out around the world in real time.
And did it always feel like the last? It'd be the last track on the record.
It always felt. It felt something.
Something big about it.
I would say it probably was, in my mind, it was always a perfect end of that album. For that chapter of this band.
With the long outro, though. Yeah. It's got the whale noises on and the...
Yeah.
And then the embossed sleeve.
The
first 1,000 copies, was it?
Yeah, I've got that.
Embossed,
yeah.
The first 1,000?
I think it was the first 1,000 were embossed. Yeah. And then it might have been 5,000, but I think maybe 1,000.
Tell the story about the silhouette that you told me on the train on the way down.
Is that the cover?
Yeah. So the silhouettes that was on the cover were taken from the video for She Comes in the Fall.
Okay.
Because it's like a psychedelic bit where we're like doing this.
Yeah, no, yeah.
What's coming out of a volcano. Yeah. So when they came through the artwork for Life, they were taking the silhouettes from the stills in the video. But they were, some of them were a bit like blurry or a bit,
or
you know.
People had, of all, had big coats on. So
yeah. So basically, the only one that's of the band, that one there is me. That one at the bottom there.
Yeah.
All the others are superheroes. So one's Spider-Man.
Oh, wow.
One's Al Jolson. One's the Joker. It's a great album, isn't it, Graham?
Yeah.
Very proud of it still. And I think, I saw you say this, but debut albums by bands.
Yeah.
It's usually, it's not been written in like a 2 or 3 month bubble, is it? You've written it over 5 years.
Yeah.
You know, from doing pubs in Oldham to ending up at the Boardwalk and then suddenly. Yeah. So it's like, debut albums are always a bit special because some of the best stuff you've ever written over a 5 year period, isn't it? Whereas album number 2 and 3, you're getting sent away for a couple of months to write it. So, like the following album, Beast Inside, could not have been more different than that. Right. It was like a completely.
And so, did you do that with Chris Nagel?
Yeah.
Beast Inside, yeah.
And it was soon after he'd worked with you, if I remember right. But that was like a completely different. That was a very dark album, you know what I mean? It had a couple of upbeat tracks on, but compared to Life, it was. A different beast, wasn't it?
Yeah, it got a bit of a hammer in our second album when really, artistically, the third album would probably have been the better second album. But Beast Inside is, it's one that, with Skidoo on it, which was the B-side of Caravan, which wasn't on the album, but it's a long sort of jammy track. Yeah. With that on it, that makes, for me, our best album, the second album.
Very progressive, isn't it?
And Chris was just the right guy to work with. You know, it's quite great history and quite sort of dark and just let us get on with it.
He was dark in his own way, wasn't he? He had some Martin Hannett vibes.
We
had, there was that Hannett connection, but also he'd done the Yago album. You know Yago, the Body Beat album. Is it called Body Beat?
Yeah.
He did that, and that was...
That's brilliant.
What, to us, it was one of the most outstanding albums of its time.
Because
of the space around the sounds.
Yeah, it's like Sackville is based on... the beat, drums and bass are based on Help off Body Beat. Great album that.
Yeah.
And again, Yago just probably just around at the wrong time, weren't they? But we love them because they used to be rehearsing out of the blue like we did, and we'd be in our room, and when we'd stop, you'd hear Yago like playing live,
proper
and it just
music.
sounded like a record, you know.
Yeah. They were just amazing musicians, weren't they?
Sort of like So Spacious, like a modern day Joy Division, but nothing like Joy Division, but everybody on their instrument knew when not to play, which is as good as being a really good guitarist or keyboard player. It's good to know when not to play.
Yeah.
Isn't it, Clint?
Absolutely.
On that note, we're going to wrap up Life. And,
is this the end of Life, Tim?
This is the end of Life. Life as we know it today.
Thanks for having us, Tim.
Yeah, thank you. Been great.
Sparrow Carpets in Sackville, concluding this listening party. Thanks to Graham Lambert and Clint Boone for joining me on this episode of my listening party to tell me all about Life. Let me finish this episode by giving you a handful of listening recommendations to keep your ears busy. I was walking down the street the other day and I heard Old Town by Phil Lynott, and it's just gorgeous, very romantic, very Irish. It's amazing. I know about Thin Lizzy and I know about Phil Lynott, but I just didn't recognise this track, and since then I've just played it. It's amazing that, you know, records can do that to you, just sneak up on you when you least expect it. We should definitely have organ-based songs, though. Small Faces. So I'm going to have Tin Soldier, classic band, one of my favourites when I was growing up. We should also use a song by The Prisoners, and I would choose an instrumental of theirs called Gravedigger. And last but not least, Brian Auger, Julie Driscoll and The Trinity, and the song's called Season of the Witch. Don't forget, if you've tuned in late and missed any of this evening's show or want to replay any previous listening parties, just search and follow Tim's Listening Party wherever you get your podcasts or on the Rayo app. There you'll find a whole archive of listening parties with the likes of New Order, The Cure, Bon Jovi and so many more. Every song is taken from Inspiro Carpet's Life. All tracks were written by Inspiro Carpet's. The album was released on Mute in April 1990. See you next time.
This is Absolute Radio.
Tim's Listening Party.